Breaking news today on Seculo. A mistrial investigation is underway in the Trump New York conviction.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. We want to hear from you. Share and post your comments or call 1-800-684-3110. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
So it's Friday night, you're President Trump, Friday evening, and you're the Trump legal team, and you get a letter from Judge Mershon, which you haven't received in a while yet. You know that you've got sentencing on July 11th, and that's likely when you'll file your motions to appeal and your motions to place a stay on any kind of sentencing. But this letter is kind of take you off guard at first because it's dated June 7th. And it was via email to both President Trump's attorney and the assistant district attorney, so someone who would work with Alvin Bragg. And it said, "Dear counsel, today the court became aware of a comment that was posted on the Unified Court System's public Facebook page, in which I now bring to your attention. In the comment, the user, Michael Anderson, states, 'My cousin is a juror and says Trump is getting convicted. Thank you, folks, for all your hard work.' Now, here's what's interesting about the comment. That was 2 days into the jury deliberation, 1 day before they announced their verdict, that you have that comment. You also, the comment was under a part of the 4th Department of the Appellate Division's Facebook page. So it was not on the trial court's Facebook page, and it was under a post that was unrelated to the Trump proceeding at all. It had nothing to do with that. And this is all coming from the official letter. I put it up on the screen again. From the judge. This isn't like the Trump team. I want to make that clear. Someone, internet sleuths didn't find this. Fox News did not find this. Newsmax didn't find it. The Trump legal team didn't find it. It was the courts, and it was the appellate court division that found it and made notice to the trial court judge, Judge Mershon. And then it goes on to say that it was under this appellate division oral argument section. Now, here's what's important. There needs to be, and there should be, as we speak, an investigation ongoing. And it could be done pretty quickly. First, you go to your jurors. So you're the court. Okay, you can conduct this on your own without really exposing any jurors to anything because you have all their information, don't have to make anything public. And in the interest of justice and also anything you're going to sentence, you do want to put this to bed. If it is some internet scam, as some are trying to say, and the post has now been interestingly deleted, maybe because this person realizes may have gotten, getting too far down the road. But, you've got your 12 jurors. You pull them, you can call them one by one or pull them all together again and say, okay, one, any of you know Michael Anderson? Okay, because that doesn't have to be the person's real name. Okay, so make sure you note that. Remember, this is an internet posting. So you don't have to use a real name. But that would be an easy one if somebody raises their hand. Is that your cousin? Okay. Did you talk to that cousin? You're under oath. You got to put him under oath when you do this. Did you talk to that cousin before, during jury deliberations and give them any indications about how the jury was going to decide on this case? So if there is a juror in there that answers yes to those questions, okay, this is grounds for a mistrial. If all these jurors under oath give you blank stares, say, not even that they don't know a Michael Anderson, but they don't, the second question to ask if they do that would be, okay, but you're under oath right now. So serious here. Did you speak to any family members about the deliberations of the jury and give them any hint into what the verdict that the jury would announce would be? And you're under oath. If somebody raises their hand, that then goes back to this and the potential. So there's ways to get at a mistrial here without this comment really ever being figured out. I want to take your calls. 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. But we've got to demand justice be done here. And justice here is the court taking it on, spending a few hours putting these people under oath and asking those questions. We'll be right back. Francis Seculo, and I think I keep wanting to underscore this because this is not something that was found by journalists. It was not something found by the ACLJ media team going through randomly the appellate division of New York's Facebook page and looking at posts that had nothing to do with the Trump case or the future Trump case that may be brought there on appeal, will certainly be on appeal there. And especially when the post is about some other appellate division, Fourth Department oral argument on this morning at 10, which had nothing to do with the Trump case at all. And the post has a person's name, Michael Anderson. It says, my cousin's a juror, and says Trump is getting convicted. Thank you, folks, for all of your hard work. Now, could someone randomly have just put that there? Yes. Yes. Could the court get enough information from the jurors? Because unlike most social media posts, this has brought up kind of a can of worms that I'm not sure. I think the media tried to dismiss too early. And I want to go to Harry Hutchins on this because, Harry, the media tried to dismiss this as this is likely a hoax. You know, it's likely this, you know, it's this person on the internet that's trying to, you know, start something and, you know, and this is what they do. And look at their profile. That's, of course, even if that name is right. But if you want to take it seriously, and it looks like they are by putting on official letterhead and notifying both parties on Friday evening last week, that you need, as the court, to call in those jurors, have them put under oath, and ask them just a series of basic questions. And I don't even think the key question is the Michael Anderson part, or even, is this your first cousin? I think the first question is, during jury deliberations, did you make any phone calls to family members that indicated how the jury was going to decide and announce their verdict the next day? Because if they did that, that alone under oath would lead to the potential for a mistrial. And what if you had two or three jurors raise your hands? Then this could open up a can of worms that's much worse than just this Facebook post.
Absolutely. And so the other corollary question is whether or not the jurors had any conversations with individuals who were not part of the jury pool. And based on this particular post, one could certainly infer that communications did in fact occur. And so I think the court has the power to compel the jurors to testify, and they need to get to the bottom of it, and they need to do so very, very quickly. And so we need to adjudicate first when the post was made, whether the poster is indeed a cousin or relative or outsider with respect to any of the jurors, because keep in mind, in theory at least, the names of the 12 jurors and the alternates were kept private throughout the Trump trial. And so I think the calls made by many Republicans for a mistrial are indeed appropriate in the sense that they are bringing appropriate pressure to bear on the court to act and act expeditiously, in part because the sentencing for Donald Trump is to take place within about a month.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, Will, and I go, you know, to me, once you've had time to digest it and you think this should open up that can of worms, and listen, you could open up that can and all those jurors could be under oath. They say, nope, I didn't do that. And then I'm not sure what else you could do other than some maybe internet research, maybe trying to tie this metadata, something like that. But the first thing you do is say, it's not even about Michael Anderson. It's, you know, this is a public story now. It's putting you under oath. It's saying, did you have conversations with people that shouldn't have been privy to those conversations that we told you not to do that could have also told someone like this? I mean, think about that. If you were speaking to someone in your family and then that person decided, you know, let's play phone tag, I'm going to call someone else and say, I've got some cool information from you that my cousin, friend, coworker, a husband, wife on the jury said that we're going to get a guilty verdict pretty soon in this case, and Donald Trump's going down.
Well, and I think that's been the problem.
And about the Facebook post,
right?
There's grounds for a mistrial there.
Once again, this is not a letter that the judge wanted to send, right? And and we got it Friday evening, so perfect timing to hopefully get lost in the shuffle of the news cycle going into a weekend. People aren't paying as much attention, but I think it also highlights what has been the problem. Many commentators and legal analysts have seen with this entire case is that it was based on an underlying crime we didn't know. There was a novel legal theory presented to get these to be highlighted and raised to felonies against the former president. And then even some of the oddities of allowing, we're going to have a short day here so this juror can go to a dental appointment. The jury wasn't sequestered in this very, very high profile case. So the judge, while I don't believe he wanted to send this, also allowed for this in some way to happen by not sequestering the jury, by not having heightened protections against something like this when you know that this is a high-profile case. It's what people that have been critical of it have been saying from the beginning, how is he going to get a fair trial? And now you have a letter that we can't look at and just dismiss out of hand of like, oh, how many people on the internet said, of course, he's going to be guilty, but that the judge had to take seriously, had to bring before. And as you see, this could potentially get short-circuited before it even gets to the appeal. But that's a question I have for you as well. Even if this, say, doesn't pan out to be a legitimate poster, they can't determine it one way or the other, and so mistrial doesn't happen. What I don't think that's off the table, but it potentially could be off the table coming forward. Do you think this gives the Trump defense another avenue on the appeal of look at just how chaotic this entire process was? It wasn't run fairly and deprived me of basic rights here.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that, listen, when you go on appeal and you start looking at, listen, getting Friday night letters after the jury's come back with their verdict about a post made while they were deliberating, and that's coming from the judge with information that came from the appellate division, you, of course, are going to include that somehow in your appeal. But before you get there, and I think you want to, I don't exactly know what you'd file, but I think you want to file something with the court that makes sure that the court is doing its due diligence. Really, the Trump campaign cannot put those jurors under oath again. They can't contact them. It's only the court. Alvin Bragg can't even do that in his team. So it's really the court now has this duty. And it's also important for the court. I mean, Harry, this is why it's important for the court to do it so that all of this, if it can be put to rest, is put to rest. Because it you go to, again, just the, are these just pre-cooked sentences against Donald Trump, and people have said that this is all cooked, this is all again set up because we're doing them in Manhattan, we're putting two lawyers on the jury pool, and they come back in 2 days that we don't even know what the actual felony is, but we do know they're going to get convicted, as the person wrote on Facebook. And they're the ones that could put them under oath and say what happened here.
Absolutely. So whatever the outcome of this particular case, first, this post suggests the impossibility that Donald Trump could, in fact, get a fair trial in New York. That's number one. Number two, the judge failed to take appropriate safeguards, as Will indicates, with respect to protecting the jurors from outside influence. So the jurors were not sequestered. Their cell phones, as I understand it, were not taken away. Their ability to communicate over the internet was not taken away. And then thirdly, the judge likely committed reversible error with respect to the jury instructions. Why? Because the judge failed to require that the jurors reach a unanimous verdict with respect to the underlying crime. And indeed, the underlying crime was not even specified in this particular case. So I think a lot of Americans believe that this particular trial was indeed unjust. And so it strengthens the argument at the end of the day for a mistrial.
know what, folks? We'll continue to take phone calls to comments on this at 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. We don't have time for the call right now, but let me encourage you as well to get those calls in. We'll take those calls. We want you to stand with the ACLJ. You know, your support is crucial to winning these fights. We're preparing to file a critical brief in the Georgia Court of Appeals there to disqualify Fannie Willis from corrupt prosecution of Trump. That is at the Georgia Court of Appeals. And we're prepared to file in the New York appeal of President Trump's conviction to defend the Constitution. Your support is crucial. We'll be talking about some more ACLJ cases when we come back from this break that we're able to do because of your financial support of the ACLJ. It's a great day to donate at ACLJ.org. And if you're able to, become a monthly supporter, one of our over 21,000 champions, keeping us in the fight every month. If you're able to do that, we'd really appreciate it. As we told you, it makes us never have to make a decision about money, but just about doing what's right. All right, welcome back to Secchio. We are taking your calls, 1-800-684-3110. Before we go to an ACLJ victory report and an update for you, I want to, again, allow you to ask those questions on this letter that came in on Friday evening. And depending on when you turned on the news at all this weekend really depended on how this letter was portrayed. When it was initially portrayed as, whoa, this is huge, this could lead to a mistrial, then people saw it and they started saying, ah, oh, this could just be, you know, an internet troll. Here's what I do, though. It's opened up now the court to give them an opportunity I think they must take to put every juror on under oath and bring them in and ask them a series of questions. And the question one is not, do you know Michael Anderson? Is that a cousin of yours? You could eventually get to that, but it's really not important, that name. What this opens up the ability to question is, did you speak to anyone you were unauthorized to speak to about the verdict in this case the day before the verdict came out, or at all during your deliberation process? And if a juror or multiple jurors raise their hand because they are under oath, guess what? You've got grounds for a mistrial. And this comment really just led us into allowing the court to open up that investigation. So you see how you could take something like this that officially came from the court, and the question doesn't have to start with Michael Anderson in this specific post. The question should start with, did you violate the rules of being a jury member? We know these jury members went to their dentist appointments. We know they went to their doctor's appointments. We know they went home at night. They were not sequestered. They lived as much as possible their normal life during this process. They went about it in a normal way. It was 6 weeks long. But the fact is, this comment that was made is made 2 days after they go into jury deliberations and a day before the verdict is released. So the court, again, the step is not, do we just confirm that this statement really came from someone's cousin? The first step is, did any of you jurors speak to family members or other people who you were unauthorized to speak to about your deliberations and the likely outcome of this trial? Because there, you could have multiple juror members raise their hand and say, or while they're under oath, and say, yes, they did. Now, you might have none. And we might not have enough here to then move forward with a mistrial. And we always want to be honest with you about that, the ACLJ. But it now puts this burden on the court to maintain its appearance of fairness and relevance. I mean, I think you have to have that investigation, Will. If you don't ask those questions, this is going to dog them for the rest of the trial.
That's right. And as Arthur on YouTube said, the whole process was a sham and should be thrown out by the appellate court. I think that when you see these issues that keep arising, whether it be the jury instructions, whether it be not allowing the FEC commissioner to testify because the judge is the only one allowed to talk about the law in this case, whether it be the scheduling of the jury and allowing for early days for dental appointments and things of that nature, it to some degree makes you question how serious the judge took the case.
Right.
when it was such a high profile case that should have been taken very seriously. And when you see this, you say, oh, great, he sent a letter, he's taking it seriously. But if the court doesn't do anything to follow up on this and to ensure that this wasn't grounds for a mistrial, if that is so the case, or if it is grounds for a mistrial, that they take it to the steps that are appropriate and take it seriously. And right now, I think looking at our audience and looking at really the way that I feel most people feel, you really question if the judge does take it serious enough, but we'll see also if he doesn't, what the appeals court does.
Yeah, let's go take a call, and then I want to go to an ACLJ victory. We'll have you updated you on. Let's go to Donna in Colorado on line one. Hey, Donna.
Hey, you've already touched on some of my question. I guess, and thank you. I really appreciate everything that you do.
Thank you.
If the judge does call these people back, and based upon the instructions he first gave them, he might not even couch the question in a way that gives them the opportunity to say yes or no. If they all say no, if they went to the dentist or they went to the candy store and they say they didn't talk to anybody, is this post now moot? Does it have no weight at all that anybody can use?
I think if you went to every jury member under oath and they said no, and you had no other evidence, I'm not sure, Will, how to proceed with that. If every one of them said, no, I did not speak to anyone outside of who I'm allowed to, which is inside this jury, about our deliberations or about the verdict that we are going to announce.
Right. But I also think while it may not lead to something like a mistrial,
right,
I do think it does give another arrow in the quiver of the defense team as they go into the appellate stage of the unorthodox way this entire case was handled. Now, that may not be the pivotal piece of evidence of, say, even look at this, but it could be just one of the pieces that give them a robust defense when it comes to an appeal process. But once again, that could take a while, and we'll see how that plays out.
I want to go to Cece Howe on a case that we knew on sometime on Friday afternoon, so after we were on the show, we would get an answer to, and that was in Manhattan Beach. Let me remind you just quickly, the individual wanted to host like a Bible study at their home. They said, no, that violates zoning ordinances because of parking. Then they said, well, we have these community rooms that are available for anyone who lives in Manhattan Beach to come and rent. And anyone can access those except for religious people or for religious reasons. And so they had already told our client, you can't do it at your house. Too many people on the street. The zoning doesn't allow that. And then when our client went to go rent one of these locations, they pointed to their rules and they said, no, you can't do it because you have a religious viewpoint. I mean, Cece, on those kind of cases, we've won it over and over again. Let's explain to people, because we told them we were giving the city attorney at Manhattan Beach until Friday to answer our demand. And so I'd call it kind of like a victory part one in what we've seen here today.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, there was a reservation policy, which was completely egregious, that allowed everything for a reservation except religious purposes. We sent the demand letter. We gave them until Friday to respond to us. And now the attorney has responded. And we do see this as a start of a win, because they said they're going to look into their policies, both the reservation policy and the zoning policy. And in the meantime, our client is able to either gather at his home or reserve one of these community centers for his Bible studies. So right now, that is a win. Our client is able to do what he is constitutionally protected of doing.
And what we want to make sure is that it's not just for our client and for, you know, this 6 months, but
absolutely,
that anyone who faces this again is able, whether they want to host it at their home or use those city centers, because I could see them trying to come back and say, listen, we said you can do it at your home, so you don't need our community centers to do this at. But that is, again, that would be viewpoint discrimination. I'd feel very confident in court if we have to go there. We're giving the city time. Remember, they would have to go through a process. Likely their city council would have to amend their rules. I think that's what the city attorney is saying, is for right now, he's good, but we've got to make sure that we've amend our rules for the future. And what we have to do then, CC, is make sure we stay on this throughout.
Absolutely.
Well, this is a victory for the individual client.
Yes.
But we need to make sure it's a victory for all.
And we will take it to the end, a victory to the end for our client, and we will take it to a victory for everyone that lives in Manhattan Beach.
You know what, folks? And you know, this is just another example of how crucial your support is to winning these battles. We keep winning. because of you and your financial contributions to the ACLJ. You can make that contribution at aclj.org, or you can become a monthly supporter, an ACLJ champion. We have 21,000 of those at aclj.org as well.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
So I want to remind you, these juries, these jurors, they had no rules about, like, staying sequestered. They weren't put into a hotel each night, and you know, the news channels weren't taken off. They were going home. They were going about their day. They were going to get appointments and doctor's appointments and dentist appointments. And some of that is because it was a six-week trial. But it was certainly, there were multiple opportunities for these jurors to commit wrongdoing, whether they were intentionally or unintentionally doing it, and then have that information taken by someone who wants to do wrongdoing and post it up on this random Facebook page that isn't part of that court, but is actually part of the appellate court's page, and make a post under one of their official posts about an oral argument that has nothing to do with President Trump or this case. So again, what do you need to do? If you are the judge and his team, so you're the judicial side of this, that's who notified President Trump's legal team. We can put it on the screen again. President Trump's legal team and the assistant district attorney, so from Alvin Bragg and the city's team, were notified by Judge Merchant about this post, that this was out there. So what do? First, you say, you bring the jurors in. You put them under oath. You ask them, the first question is not, do you know Michael Anderson, and is this what you said to him? The first question you ask is, did you speak to anyone outside the jury pool that you're, or anyone that you were not specifically allowed to speak to, that we made very clear to you not to talk about the case, and tell them a day before or so what the verdict was going to be? So you've opened up the jury deliberations to them, and you told them, well, Donald Trump's going down for this. That alone would be grounds. You don't have to have this comment in a Facebook page, Will, for that to be serious enough to declare a mistrial.
That's right. And that's obviously what we're looking at now here, is that, one, how does the court handle this? And also, how does the defense handle this? What within their limited capacity at this level, obviously, I think they could probably do a lot more with it once it does get to the appellate level. But what do they do within their limited capacity here to try to compel the court to get the right answers here, and which the court should be doing? That should be the goal of the court, is to protect the integrity of the legal system. But unfortunately, we're not certain that this entire thing has much integrity to it. But I think we should go to the phones real quick here. And let's go to Mark calling from South Carolina on line 3.
Hey, Mark.
You're on Seculo.
Hey, guys. I really appreciate what you do. I think you're hammering home some of the points of my comment, with one exception. So as far as I know, the jury was not sequestered. I don't think it matters if someone talked to a cousin or not, because they weren't sequestered. They deliberate. Some of them may be on the fence as to whether they're going to vote guilty or not guilty. They have access to this Facebook page, and they see that comment, and it sways their vote. Why that Facebook page isn't monitored and scrubbed on a daily basis is beyond me. But I think there's real grounds just on that basis. And I think the entire court case was sloppy from beginning to end.
Well, and Mark, one of the interesting things here, because MSNBC immediately called it a debunked post. CNN said, we don't have all the facts here yet, which is true, and that's what we're saying. But the media rushed to try to discredit it.
Steal the story.
But what I think is interesting is that this person described himself as a professional troll. He used more colorful language, but as a professional troll. That doesn't necessarily mean he's not telling the truth in this situation. Yeah. But also, if he were a professional troll, I feel like he would have gone to a more high profile place to actually post this,
right,
than going to the fourth department of the appellate division.
Yeah, you're hiding the comment about this within a Facebook page. Let's just be honest about it. A Facebook page that so far, under the post that where it was, had nothing to do with the Trump trial. Nothing at all to do with the Trump trial. I mean, so when we get back, we are going to talk to Rick Rennell about this. Again, a senior advisor to the ACLJ on national security and foreign policy. And why the court system must get to the bottom of it and answer this for the American people, as Will said, to keep some integrity inside our judicial system. So what do we need you to do? We're preparing to file in Georgia to remove Fannie Willis from that case. We're representing to file New York's appeal of his of President Trump's conviction. If we get there, there isn't a mistrial cleared. We want you to stand with the ACLJ. Donate today. All right, welcome back to Secular. We are taking your calls as well at 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. But I want to go right to Rick Rennell, who, again, handles national security and foreign policy for us here at the ACLJ as a senior advisor. And, Rick, I want to go right to the fact that the IDF was able, in a pretty daring operation, to free four Israeli hostages, one who was very high profile, each of which was high profile at this point, but one, a woman who was very high profile because of the way she was captured on this motorcycle and screaming out, please don't take me, please don't take me, please don't kill me. And though there was a senior IDF officer killed in this raid, the idea that Israel and the IDF, Rick, could get this deep inside Gaza and carry out this mission, I think has shown how their military efforts have been successful overall. And it kind of proves the point about what they've been doing, which is to make it that much easier, not perfect, because, again, an IDF soldier was killed, but easier that when they need to go in deeper into Gaza, they are able to get their special forces inside.
Look, from the beginning of this incredible, horrific tragedy and killing and terrorist attack, we have, the U.S. government has slowed down the Israelis, and I think that's been a problem. We should have said to the Israelis, literally by midnight on October 7th, we should have said, get in there, get the hostages returned, get everything done that you need to do and crush Hamas and do it as quickly as possible, not call for all of the ceasefire for months and months and months. There shouldn't be a ceasefire until you get the hostages returned. That's just plain and simple. And we still have hostages. How many days has it been? It's 280 something days. And it's climbing. Every single day we wake up, there are more hostages. So I just don't believe that we should be telling Israel to do anything but get the hostages returned. I do believe that they should do it a lot faster. And the way to do it faster is to get the U.S. government to lay off their back and stop telling them to slow down and to give them unequivocal support until we get the hostages back. All of these other questions about what comes next, two-state solution, those are issues that we need to deal with sequentially. And now is the time to get the hostages back.
I mean, I think, again, and it shows that Israel has the capability to do that, and especially if the world had Israel's back, if the U.S. had Israel's back and realized that you've got living hostages that you are able to go in and extract. And then when you do that, you will find out a lot of interesting information. For instance, where are these hostages being held? They're being held in the homes of Gazans, not by some, in some Hamas camp. So they are spread out. One, I think, was being held by a doctor.
That's right. One was being held by a doctor and one by an Al Jazeera journalist.
By a journalist. So, I mean, again, Rick, it kind of proves Israel's point to the world that it makes it very difficult when you have to fight these battles, as they do against terrorism, to know when you go inside a place like Gaza, who is the combatant and who is the everyday citizen, because these were everyday citizens on their face who were holding hostages illegally.
Look, if you're giving aid and comfort to a terrorist organization, then you are part of that terrorist organization. So anyone who's giving aid and comfort to Hamas should be treated as Hamas supporters. Look, I believe that the Palestinian people are not governed well by the government of Hamas, if you want to call them that. But these leaders in Hamas are convincing people that this is their only choice, and it's not. I think that we need to be much more aggressive about telling the Palestinian people, you must reject this terrorist organization, Hamas. I do believe that there would be many more Palestinians that were not killed if we allowed Israel to go in and find Hamas and the supporters from the beginning and not hold them up, this is now, again, 280 some odd days. I don't even know anymore. It could be 290. And we've just watched as the U.S. government, as the Biden administration, has really struggled to know whose side they're on. They're literally not equipped to talk about these issues in an intelligent way. They're trying to play both sides. And I think that's been the problem. That's why we've lingered so long. And that's why there's so many people who are, confused and in the way, and we can't figure out who the Hamas supporters are.
And I think, again, it underscores why Israel is continuing their operations. If you are able to still liberate and go in and get these living hostages who were kidnapped on October 7th, and you're able to extract them successfully, that is worth doing and continuing to do so until Hamas accepts some kind of deal which would return all of these hostages so that you don't, as the IDF, need to go deep inside Gaza or into neighborhoods or into these people, like you said, who are giving aid and comfort to Hamas. Thus, they are part of Hamas. They are that is how the international law looks at them, is that if you are holding hostages illegally for a terrorist group, you are part of that terrorist group because you are aiding and assisting in their ongoing terror and illegal activity. Now, let me go to the second part, which I think, again, we are seeing across Europe. I certainly saw it when we were at our European Center for Law and Justice offices just a couple months ago. And that was the right in Europe, very successful in parliamentary elections for the European Parliament. It looks like the center right is still going to have control there. But then I look at how it affects, really, Rick, individual countries. And the first one you go to is a country like France, where their president, right after hosting President Biden, and just a few weeks before they host the Olympic Games, has dissolved parliament and called for snap elections, which has two rounds in France, because of how well the right in France did within those European Parliament elections, that it actually hurts his mandate to govern if that's truly who the people will elect at the national level, not at the international or regional level, but at the national level. So he's putting all his eggs in the basket and saying, I don't think that they will actually elect that group to govern. But we could see some pretty unique outcomes here as we are just seeing the kind of fallout from, or the left, they would call it the fallout, for us seeing the victories of the right coming back in Europe. Many who I've met with, Rick, who have said that they have adopted that, a France first policy. And the idea that if we promote America first and they promote a France first policy, that's going to be a better policy for both America and France.
Yeah, look, to be clear, this is the European elections, and each country that's in a part of Europe elects members to represent them in the European Parliament. And what is interesting is the pendulum has completely swung away from progressive policies and towards conservative policies. There are many socialist governments in Europe, and the people have been speaking over the last couple of days to say, we're going to reject that. We're going to go with other traditional ideas of governing. That spells disaster. I mean, Europe, I think, is really up and down right now. That spells disaster for people who have put all of their hope into these progressive policies. I actually think that places in America like California and New York should be the first ones to stand up and say, we tried these progressive policies. It doesn't work. We got to go back to the middle. We got to go back to a more conservative approach on homelessness, on the inflation, on the economy, on our schools and funding and the budget issues. All of these issues, you need a conservative approach. You don't need big government deciding. And that's what's happening in Europe. And I hope that it's going to catch on here in America so that we see in state capitals, like European capitals, the same type of fix, moving away from progressive policies and towards conservative ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so interesting here is again, it's not even just what's going to happen inside the European Parliament, but what is happening now domestically in some of the major countries that send send parliamentarians to the European Parliament, to the point that Macron said, I've got to call snap elections, because if this is really where the people of France want to go, I will not be able to govern, and so I'm going to allow them. It doesn't mean he steps down, by the way, but it does say, like, we will see a new makeup of their assembly in France in just the next couple of weeks. And if the right-leaning parties gain the most votes and put together the coalition, it's a very different France. It would have a very different prime minister, and that would lead into a presidential election with, again, this kind of theory of putting France first if you were French. But that's not anti-American either. Rick, as always, we appreciate all of your insight and commentary on the show. And folks, you know why we've got Rick on our team and why we can cover all the issues that we have so far just on the show today. It's been a quick one. Is we're able to do it because of your support financially of the American Center for Law and Justice, right? It's flat out. We've asked you if you are financially able to become an ACLJ champion. That's a recurring donor to the ACLJ. You can do that at aclj.org and give monthly or make a one-time donation. All right, welcome back to Secchio. Listen, we are going to follow very closely to this letter that came out on Friday evening from Judge Merton to the Trump and to the Trump legal team and to Alvin Bragg's team about this Facebook post. As I explained to you, what can I think it opens is not just is this person directly tied to an individual who's on the jury as they claim to be a first cousin of, and again, or if it's just some kind of internet troll. But what it does almost necessitate the court doing is bringing these jurors back in, or former jurors back in, putting them under oath, and before ever asking questions that specific, just asking them, did you communicate about proceedings that went on inside the jury room that would indicate the way the jury was going to come down on a verdict for or against Donald Trump? And if the answer is yes, and multiple jurors may say yes, they may all say no. Depending on how that is answered, this doesn't even really have to come into play. This is what opened the door to that question being asked, but you could have been one of those jurors, and now you've got to answer a question that is very uncomfortable, especially if you're under oath and you feel like you did give away, or you were proud to tell people, we're going to convict this guy. And so now it allows you, again, they should investigate that and then let both parties know, as they already have about finding this, what they found from the actual jurors. Did they all deny having any conversations? Okay, that's one thing. Did a couple say they did have conversations? Okay, let's do a little more research into who their contacts are, who they might know, who did they have those conversations with? Because someone could be claiming to be a first cousin and using a name that's real or not real, but who still has contact with someone there. So again, this post was important enough that a judge who was very hostile to President Trump throughout this six-week trial and his legal team felt like he had to get this out immediately to attorneys well before Donald Trump were still a month away from his sentencing, his appeal of both the Senate, or he'll appeal to get a stay on the sentence, and his appeal of the guilty verdict. So, can this be figured out before that? It should be. And I think the onus right now, Will, it's on the court system. The Trump team can do what they can to research it. Again, if you're the government, the DOJ side, you can do as much to investigate, or the DA side in this case, the state side. But ultimately, it's the court, it's the judge himself who can get to the bottom of this.
That's right. And it's not up to the defense team to uphold the integrity of a prosecution of their client. Yeah. It's up to the court to uphold the integrity of the judicial system. But let's get to some calls here. We're going to get to as many as we can here. Let's go first to Cindy in Texas on line 4. Cindy's watching on Rumble. Welcome to Secchio. You're on the air.
Hey, Cindy.
Thank you. This is a hypothetical. I'm not an attorney, but I think how the question would be posed to the jury would be very important, because if I'm having a conversation with a juror and I ask them if Trump will be found guilty. Maybe they didn't verbalize that, but it could have been, you know, a wink, a nod, a thumbs up, that kind of thing. So how they pose the question, do you think that that's equally important?
That's how the question has to be posed. Did you have any contact at all with individuals that you were barred from having contact with about the trial, about the jury deliberations over the last couple of days before this statement was found? Because then if anybody raises their hand or under oath says, yes, I did, then you can move for a mistrial. And really this comment was just the comment that opened up the door, Will, for the judge and the court system to be able to ask those questions directly.
That's right. And once again, the jurors aren't supposed to have any contact. They're not even really supposed to be out there saying, I'm a juror.
Right.
So to her point, even if any sort of interaction, if someone's asking you, how's the trial going, that could be a problematic situation because they're not supposed to be saying, hey, guess who I'm a juror right. for. But let's go to Bob in Florida on line five. Bob, you're watching on YouTube. You're on the air.
Hey, Bob.
Hi, I got a question. Could Judge Mershon be using this Facebook post like a relief valve to remove the political prisoner label from Trump, considering how much he's fundraised from it and how much his numbers has gone up in the polls? Is that a possibility?
I do not think that they want to help Donald Trump, any of these individuals. So if they didn't have to write this letter on Friday evening, they wouldn't have had to write it. But they felt that it was serious enough to not wait until Monday right. or Saturday, that they needed to tell, because the appellate vision told them, that they needed to tell Trump's team and the Department of Justice prosecutors with Jack Smith, with Alvin Bragg's office, that they found this. And so that you then, as a team, demand that the court system and their counsels go and figure out from the jury by putting them under oath if any of the jury members fit the profile of what it was described in this Facebook post.
All right, let's go to Joe calling from Louisiana on line one. Joe, you're on Seculo.
Hey, Joe.
Yes, good morning. Look, the troubles that I'm seeing is the hypocrisy of the Democrat Party and basically the soul of our country. Concerning abortion, we've killed 70 million innocent souls since 1974, 62 million total in World War II. So we've killed more innocent people with this abortion thing than World War II worldwide. Second, we dropped bombs on Dresden, Frankfurt, Hamburg, Berlin, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, to the tune of 1.2 million civilians. And we have the nerve, the audacity, the hypocrisy of the Democrat Party, Joe Biden especially, and his group of lefty loonies, to actually tell the Israeli people that they can't defend themselves from treacherous attack on their homeland terrorists. I find that reprehensible. Totally reprehensible.
I do too. I think that, again, this idea that you can support, on the one hand, some military operations, but that, you know, if it's an ally that is not so popular for your base right now, Will, you want to, you start the demonization process. You start saying, like President Biden has, that you've got to end this conflict now, even while you were able to extract not the bodies of hostages, but living and breathing hostages 6 and 7 months later.
That's right. And obviously, we know the truth here. We know the reality of what Israel is dealing with and what they need to do. But you see the left in the media so quickly after freeing four hostages that have been held hostage by a terrorist organization since October of 2023. And you automatically start seeing people on the left be like, can you believe Israel raided the home of a journalist? To free a hostage, the Al Jazeera quote unquote journalist. It's offensive to call them a journalist because they were holding a hostage for Hamas. Or can you believe that they raided the home of a doctor that protects children in Gaza? What about the children of Israel that are being held captive by that doctor in Gaza?
Orphans.
Right.
I mean, the truth is, we are ready to fight. So we're going to fight with a critical brief in the Georgia Court of Appeals to disqualify Fannie Willis We've also prepared the New York appeal of Trump's conviction to defend the Constitution. Now, we need you to stand with us. We need you to make a donation to the ACLJ. It's how we do this work. It's how, when we're in the room saying, can we represent those whistleblowers? You know, it's going to be long. It's going to be tedious. Well, we know we can because we have the resources from you, even if we need to bring in other attorneys for the case. So why don't you go to aclj.org today and donate if you can.